Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how the Trump campaign's media strategy has shifted going into November's election.
And we continue our last resort series with a look at how a tire company helped transform the West Valley's tourism industry.
But first, today will likely be the first in 113 days that the high temperature will be below 100 degrees here in the Valley. We shattered the record of the longest string of 100-degree days this summer in what will go down in history as the hottest Phoenix summer on record. And it's looking like the number of heat-related deaths in the Valley could break more records. As of September 7th, the Maricopa County Department of Public Health reports 209 heat-related deaths, with 427 more under investigation. This time last year, there were slightly fewer deaths confirmed. Either way, our first guest this morning says it's too many. Dr. David Sklar is an emergency room physician at Valleywise Health, the county's large safety net hospital. He wrote in an op-ed in the Arizona Republic that last summer he was surprised by the sheer volume and severity of the record-breaking heat wave on people coming to the ER. He compared it to treating patients during the AIDS epidemic and during the outbreak of COVID-19. I spoke with him more about it and how it compares to what he's seen so far this summer.
Well, really, this past summer and even the summer before have been unique in my own personal experience, because at times I felt like I could make a difference in terms of saving people who were dying, but also the numbers of people who were coming in day after day and were on the edge of death was something that I had really never experienced before. Mm. And I've seen people through the COVID pandemic and through the AIDS epidemic that we had back in the 80s. And there were a lot of very, very sick people that I ended up taking care of. But what was really different about this was that it was unexpected. And the people were in such an acute state of being near death, in that they were unconscious and gasping for breath and losing control of urine and bowels, and blood pressure was low. And they had body temperatures of 108, 109, 110, wow, which was unlike anything I had ever seen. And this was something that we were seeing day after day during those really warmest days that we were having in Phoenix.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we had to just take action immediately. And fortunately, we had a team of people in the emergency department who kind of had a pretty good idea of what we could do to save people, which was, first of all, trying to cool them in these ice water baths that we used. And actually, we used body bags that were able to kind of hold the water and the ice that we then covered patients with.
I mean, but it sounds like you had to really improvise. Like, as you said, this was unexpected. Why was it so unexpected? Like, I mean, we always have hot summers in the Valley. They are getting incrementally hotter. Was it that stretch through July last summer where we just did not get a respite from 110 and above?
Well, yes. So I think what I noticed was that once we got to really high temperatures, particularly up over about 115, it seemed like the numbers of patients that we were seeing increased substantially. And you know, the year before, when we were up around 119, we got lots of patients coming in near death. This year, although we had more sustained high temperatures, so I think everybody knows we were over 100 degrees for over 100 days, but we didn't have quite the blip in terms of these extreme temperatures up in the range of like 118, 119, which seemed to be pushing people really over the edge. Mm. And particularly if they were patients who already had vulnerabilities, such as problems with their heart or their kidneys or lungs, so that they were already vulnerable, or people who didn't have good living conditions. They didn't have air conditioning in their home. They may have been living on the street. In some cases, there were people who had used drugs such as methamphetamine. Yeah. And so these were more vulnerable. And then the additional amount of heat in the environment in 2023. And we still had high temperatures in 2024, but at that level, a lot of people just couldn't, couldn't sustain it. They couldn't sweat or cool off enough. They couldn't get access to cooling. Mm-hmm. And so their body temperatures went very high, and they became unconscious and collapsed and ended up near death.
Wow. Right. So you're bringing up the comparison there between this summer and last summer. This summer has, you know, broken more records. Probably it's officially the hottest summer on record. But like you said, we didn't have that sustained, incredibly high temperatures like we saw last July. And yes, the verdict is not in yet on how many heat deaths we will have tallied by the summer's end. But I wonder, from your point of view, has anything gotten better? Have you been more prepared? Have there been better strategies, better outcomes from institutions and from, you know, people on the ground like you?
Yes. Well, I think from the treatment perspective, we have made some great improvements in that we now really have educated all of our health professionals on how to cool patients quickly. And I do believe that how quickly we are able to cool folks makes a huge difference in terms of their outcomes. And we can usually now get people from 110, 109 down to about 103, which is when we take them out of the body bag, within a half hour to 45 minutes. And I think that makes a big difference. The fire department has also instituted treatment in the field, in which they're putting patients in these body bags with water and ice. And so cooling them before the patients even arrive at the emergency department.
Right.
And that's made a big difference, I think.
Yeah.
And then the community, we have more resources. So now we have cooling centers, more cooling centers. They're staying open longer, and they're more, I would say, more attention to kind of try and identify people early and recognize that they're in trouble and getting them help.
Mm-hmm.
So from that perspective, I think we've made huge strides. Where we probably haven't made as much strides is just trying to identify who's at risk and intervening before they end up getting overheated. Because once people get really overheated, and if their heart should stop, it's almost impossible to kind of revive them. So if we can get them before they have the cardiac arrest, even if their blood pressure is low and they're unconscious, we've had a fair amount of success. And I would say more than half of the people who we resuscitate are able to leave the hospital and in many cases walk out of the hospital under their own power and not have permanent damage. So, that was, I think, an improvement. But I don't think we've made enough progress in terms of preventing this from happening with more housing options for people in the summer and identifying the people at risk and trying to get them out of harm's way.
So you're talking about some of the big shifts that have happened on a community level in terms of cooling centers, expanding hours, giving people options, handing out water, like these campaigns, right, that are coordinated and really aimed at trying to reduce heat deaths. Is it enough, though? Like, when you're talking about prevention, what would that look like in your mind?
Well, I don't think it's enough. I think we need to do more work, actually, in analyzing all the people who are dying. So I've actually talked about developing a death review team. We would get the data from the medical investigator and bring together people from the community to look at the cases where people died, if they died at home or if they died in a park, or in some cases they die in garages or trailers where they don't have air conditioning, and try to understand each one of the deaths and what we could do to prevent it from happening next year. Communicating with family members or friends or others who knew the people who died and figure out why they died and why we weren't able to prevent this from happening.
Mm-hmm.
And we have death review teams for other problems like intimate partner violence or pediatric deaths. And I think we could do this for heat. I don't think it's acceptable to have 600 people in our community dying in the summer year after year. We've now had 2 years in a row where we'll probably be up over 600 deaths. And I don't think we should accept that as just one of the unfortunate consequences of living in a hot environment, living in Phoenix.
All right. We will leave it there for now. That is Dr. David Sklar, an emergency room physician at Valleywise Health, as well as associate dean for ASU's new medical school, joining us. Dr. Sklar, thank you so much for coming on the show and telling us about your perspective and your experience here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Early voting starts in Arizona in less than a month, and this year's ballot will be a long one. And officials have been working to translate that ballot into other languages as required by federal law. That's what part of Proposition 314 sounds like in Navajo. What we just heard is part of the process of translating the ballot into Navajo, a process that, as my next guest reports, is challenging and not without controversy. Jen Fifield is a reporter with VoteBeat and recently attended a meeting during which this process was taking place. She joins me to talk about what she saw and heard. And Jen, tell me a little bit about what this meeting was like, because it's something I think most people have not seen.
Right. So as you know, we have a very long and complicated ballot this year. We have 13 long propositions that are very complex and very controversial. So this meeting was meant to bring a translator together with county and state officials to nail down exact language in Navajo that voters will then hear, be able to hear through audio recordings or poll workers at the polls. This is because Navajo is a traditionally oral language, so they weren't actually creating a physical written ballot, but they did have to get the wording very precise to match this very precise and well-argued language on some of these controversial measures.
How easy or difficult was that to do? Because I would imagine there are some words that are in, for example, policy that might not sort of roll off the tongue in other languages.
Definitely not, and especially these very historical languages that are oral. So you might not have a word for, government in the same way that you do. That's a bad example, but these more complicated government words, they actually came up with a dictionary, though, here to kind of translate the more common words. What we're really looking at and they're struggling with is these words in the propositions that are like abortion or border crossing or, sex trafficking or some of the words that they might not have traditionally in their language.
One of the words you wrote about that I thought was so interesting was the word fentanyl and how there's no word in the Navajo language for that. But the translators were trying to figure out what other words and what meaning they were trying to get across by using that word.
That was a really interesting conversation because you can see that, if you're trying to translate the word fentanyl, you're trying to tell people that it's a drug, it's not a medicine, it's not a healing, it's not meant to heal. But when you look at our English language proposition, and this was talking about, criminalizing selling fentanyl that causes the death of a person, we're not really explaining what fentanyl that is, so they have to take their own liberties. And I think that's why it was important to get the group of people in the room, although there were complaints that this wasn't a completely open process.
Yeah, I'm curious about that and also some complaints that you reported on about the actual translations, like how they turned out both in this election and in prior ones.
So there's been complaints about these traditionally oral languages. This is a requirement under federal law that counties, if they have a certain percentage of people who speak a certain language and don't speak English well, they need to do this. They're required to under federal law. For years, the Navajo Nation has been trying to get better translation for their residents. And we have a settlement agreement here telling them how to do that. And there's also groups like the Human Rights Commission, the Navajo Nation Human Rights Commission, that's been listening to these translations after they're done and saying that they do want a seat at the table when it's done to try to make sure that the translation is accurate.
Why were some of the groups and some of the people who were left out of this meeting left out? Like, for example, the president of the Navajo Nation was apparently not invited to this.
What I was told from the Secretary of State's office is they were trying to make it a smooth process where the translator could meet and there wouldn't be much disruption. But when I talk to translating experts on this, it is best to get context from the community itself on how they speak and their different dialects. And so having some of that outside feedback would have been helpful. But I think that with the state's process is actually a lot better than happens across the country, which is a sad thing. But, some places have not met at all. They haven't translated different parts of the ballot. And so the fact that they are meeting and trying does say something about Arizona right now.
Is there an estimate as far as how many people will need this translation, either the written one or the audio?
There wasn't, but we did take a look at some census data, VoteBeat, when we did this story. So there's around 71,000 Arizonans of voting age in that speak Navajo, and about 1 in 10 of them aren't fluent in English. And so this translation would be helpful to them, not saying that all of them would need it. So a lot of the elders, that's what they call more older adults in Navajo culture, bring their family or do this at home. So, you know, how many people will need this at the polls is going to be less than that one in 10, but it's still a requirement that it's available.
Right. And will there be actual translators on site at polling places on Election Day if people choose to go that direction?
Well, there should be. And there's argument about what kind of translator you might need. Do you just need a poll worker who speaks Navajo? Do you need a professional translator? I think right now, a lot of counties will rely on people, poll workers who speak Navajo that aren't official translators. With so much debate about the English language of this proposition, those translators might not be doing it exactly the way that the ballot says, which could be, you know, in issues such as abortion, important to watch, which is one of the reasons I wanted to write this story, to tell people how it was and wasn't happening.
That's a really interesting point, because as we know, there was a lot of disagreement about the English words that would be used in the ballot, especially the summaries of the propositions. I can only imagine how difficult it is to try to capture exactly that in another language, be it Navajo or really any other language.
Right. And some of the professional translators I spoke to this story really emphasize that you're not supposed to add more context. You're not, you know, that's incorrect. You can't give people more context than what's on the ballot. You can explain it well and do it correctly, but, you know, you shouldn't be making up your own explanations. So it really is going to be, you know, depending on the person, depending on how well they read the translation that's provided to them. And if they can read it too, it's all going to depend on where you're at and where you choose to vote.
So based on some of the experts with whom you spoke, like, obviously the process in Arizona isn't perfect, but I wonder if there's a sense that it's not perfect, but it's probably the best that we can do right now, or are there ideas for maybe how to do this better?
Well, I think I spoke with Allison Neswood, who is with the Native American Voting Rights Organization. They sue counties that aren't doing this correctly. She said she really doesn't know if any counties are doing this absolutely correct. If she took a closer look, the process isn't very transparent, so she might not be able to do that. But if you do look, you're going to find problems. They just emphasized, you know, involving the community as much as you can, having two professional translators who can bounce things off one on each other, and trying to stick to just what's on the ballot. So we're going to see how well Arizona did that this year.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see on Election Day. All right. That is Jen Fifield, a reporter with VoteBeat. Jen, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we're taking a look inside the tangled history of Black congregants in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
In Mormon discourse, Black people were denied the priesthood because of this so-called biblical curse that derived from the Old Testament, that Black people were cursed from God. And they didn't really address that. And they didn't say in 1978, this is no longer the teaching of the church.
We'll hear from an author of a new book chronicling the struggle for racial equality in the church.
But first, former President Donald Trump has never run a traditional campaign. But as the 2024 election season enters its home stretch, several journalists have noted an intriguing trend in Trump's media strategy. For weeks now, Trump has dedicated hours of his time to long, freewheeling conversations with podcasters, YouTubers, and live streamers. Few of them are household names, but all of them command massive online audiences. So is Trump mining an undervalued resource or wasting his time? McKenna Kelly is a senior reporter at Wired, and she's a close observer of this burgeoning corner of the political media ecosystem. As she told the show's Sam Dingman, she was particularly intrigued by Trump's recent appearance on a show hosted by 23-year-old Aiden Ross, who rose to fame by live streaming himself playing video games.
He was able to get Donald Trump on his stream on Kick.
Do you know what live streaming is on these platforms?
More or less, yeah.
Yeah.
It's the new wave.
I'm going to explain it to you, right? Okay. So I'm going to show you this chat right now.
It was about an hour and a half long program where Trump was able to say about anything that he wanted to say.
You weren't allowed to say Merry Christmas. I got it back. Yeah. But
It's a nice crowd, huh?
Even if you're Jewish, they like to say Merry Christmas. Every one of my Jewish friends say, we love Merry Christmas.
I'm Jewish. I love Merry
good.
Christmas.
Good. And, too. You know, Kamala doesn't.
She doesn't like
no,
it.
She doesn't want you to use Merry Christmas.
Wow.
She
thinks
this, for me, fits into kind of a broader, interesting phenomenon about the Trump campaign this cycle, because since that appearance, we have also seen Trump sit down with Lex Fridman and Theo Vaughn for these very long, freeform podcast interviews. I also sort of think, tell me if you disagree, we could count Trump's Spaces chat with Elon Musk on X as kind of a podcast interview. Do you think that's fair to say?
No, that's definitely fair to say. I think the important part when discussing all of this isn't necessarily if it was a podcast or a stream or something like that, but just realizing that this is long form. These people aren't journalists, and they're basically just having this like casual conversation where, unlike the debate where he was being fact-checked on a lot of the things Donald Trump said, Aidan Ross, all those people are not going to fact-check Trump.
So as an observer of this corner of what I guess we would now call the media, because many of these folks have very, very large audiences in the millions, what do you think, or who do you think Trump is trying to speak to in appearing on these shows?
Well, when you ask, you know, there was questions being asked of Trump, like, why did he go on Aidan Ross? Well, he said it's because his son, Barron, watches Aidan. It's like young males, disaffected males, people who, you know, these people who get engaged in this like hyper-masculine, disaffected part of the internet, oftentimes incel folks. Now, I don't want to call Barron an incel, right? But I'm just looking at demographics. And that seems to be it, which is kind of wild compared to 2016 and 2020, where it's, you know, Trump had a really tight grasp on that demographic. And maybe these people just aren't as excited.
Yeah, well, I'm curious to know your take on this. There was a piece in The Guardian recently that looked at this same constellation of influencers, content creators. And the argument in that piece was essentially that by engaging with them to the extent that he did in 2016 and 2020, Trump very much elevated these folks to the point where, you know, we're now talking about them here on public radio. but that a big part of what resonated with that community about his message was this idea that you can't trust anything, and that these sort of like traditional levers of power and influence are all fake and full of lies. And that the long tail of that has actually been that the folks who watch these shows are tuning out from politics and declining to participate. So am I hearing you right that it seems like a possible justification for Trump in making these appearances is to try to salvage their votes?
This is where they are now, right? They mm-hmm. are tuning mm-hmm. into these podcasts. They are tuning into these streams. And even since like 2016, and I think even 2020, the internet has changed tremendously. Back in 2020, Trump could just tweet, and that went everywhere. You had reporters who were just like reporting on his tweets. And now, right, he's on Truth Social. They don't get spread as widely. He's back on Twitter, but he's not using it as much because I probably think he doesn't see it to his advantage anymore. Mm-hmm. And now the internet has become so much more fractured. We have so many different types of Twitter, so many different types of, you know, video platforms, from Reels to TikTok, that these campaigns, including the Kamala Harris campaign, they've had to find people in these specific niche communities who have these large followings in order to reach the same people that they were doing easily, you know, even 4 years ago.
So in that vein, I'm curious to know, did you happen to watch Trump's or listen to Trump's appearance on Theo Vaughn?
Yes, I did.
Okay. What did you make of the part of that conversation where Vaughn kept asking Trump about his brother?
Did you guys ever do anything fun together, like one nice memory that you have with him?
He had a great talent for flying. He was a pilot.
Oh, sweet.
And he loved it. And
did
he
ever fly with him?
I did. I flew with him. He was a great pilot. But ultimately, he had to give that because of the alcohol. He had to give that up, which was a hard thing for him to do, but he had to give that up.
Tell me, McKenna, what you made of that sequence, because it, for me, it was a version of Donald Trump that I had not seen previously.
I think that mostly has to do with the interviewer, right? People love Theo Von because of the people that he has on and the conversations that they have. Specifically, he'll bring on someone who's just like a lunch lady, right? And they'll talk about what is it like being a lunch lady, right? And he's able to kind of get at the heart of this kind of like human part. It's not just this like small segment of men that watches Theo Von. A lot of women on TikTok love him. If Trump's team thought Theo was one of these creators, they were wrong. And I think that's the main reason why Theo was able to get that out of Trump. I think, you know, what it really says is how much the information ecosystem has changed. Trump can bypass traditional media, really, at this point. He can't do it entirely, but it's getting to the point where the way that you reach people is these people with extremely niche audiences, and it may make it easier for these candidates to engage with the right group of people that they're trying to reach out to. But at the same time, right, it really kind of defeats any overarching narrative.
Interesting. So as the ecosystem gets more fragmented, so too does the narrative that the ecosystem is supposed to help build.
Right, because you're driving home a message on abortion rights to one group of people, whereas you might be trying to do a funny, goofy meme to young people or something like that. And it's interesting to think, you know, how do you create that kind of cohesive narrative in an information ecosystem that really doesn't like it?
Well, McKenna Kelly is a senior reporter at Wired. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Yeah, this was great.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Travel and tourism have been big industries in the Phoenix area for decades. Visitors from the East Coast or Midwest have headed to the Valley looking for something different, or maybe just some sunshine. We're exploring the history and future of resorts in the Valley as a resort community in a series called Last Resorts. To do that, we're traveling from Paradise Valley to Litchfield Park, visiting some of the Valley's oldest and newest resorts, and hearing how they've impacted the region from art and architecture to how people all over the world view the West.
From all over the world come visitors to relax and rest in the sun-drenched desert of Arizona. Dude ranches, great resort hotels, inns.
Scottsdale is delightful and clean and new.
Phoenix, a simply splendid city. Don't worry for a minute about a place to stay.
There is a ruggedness here, a loveliness here, that combines into a package of colorful memories. History, wildlife, entertainment, grandeur, they're all here awaiting you on your Arizona holiday.
And today, we visit Litchfield Park and the Wigwam Resort. Now, it's a well-known resort, but it didn't start out that way. To walk me through its history and impact on the West Valley, I met Lisa Hegarty there. She's executive director at the PW Litchfield Heritage Center, which focuses on the history of the Southwest Valley. She says celebrities from Ethel Merman and Frank Sinatra to Jesse Owens and Mickey Mantle would come and stay at the Wigwam over the years. But early on, it was a very specific and small group of visitors who would spend time there. Sitting in a living room-like setup, complete with couch and fireplace, I asked Hegarty to tell me about the room in which we were sitting.
So we are in the very original portion of the Wigwam Resort. It's an adobe building, and it was built in 1918. And when it was known as the Organization House. And it was built for the purpose of housing visiting executives from the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company. And the reason why people from Goodyear Tire and Rubber would have been coming out here is because Goodyear came out to grow long staple cotton as a key component of their rubber tires at the time. And so this area, Litchfield Park, was quite remote from Phoenix. It was an all-day affair to try and get out here. The roads were not in good shape. So with all the hardship of making the trip out here, they decided it made sense to build lodging for visiting executives. And originally it would house about six people. It was really rustic settings. But this room here has the original adobe fireplace. And it was sort of the living room of the organization house from the beginning.
So at what point did this expand to not just be a living room, but to sort of be a place that people who were not tire and rubber executives would come and stay?
So it was pretty popular with the executives and their wives if they brought their, you know, wives and family out from the get-go. And so it would gradually expand initially to house about 24 people within the decade. And by 1929, Goodyear Tire and Rubber decided that they would open the wigwam to the public. So they opened on Thanksgiving Day in 1929 to the public.
Which is not that long after the stock market crash.
No, right. It would have been right in the middle of all of that. Mm-hmm.
Was there demand for something like that back then, here?
You know, I think it was part of a trend. You see that with other resorts around the valley. And it is kind of in line with that popularization of the West and coming out and experiencing a warmer climate for the winter. But also, they were marketing to the very wealthy and probably the people least affected by the Great Depression and the stock market crash.
So for people who came here in 1929, let's say in the 30s, what would they do? What else was around here?
Well, Goodyear Tire and Rubber had farming operations for about 17,000 acres that encompassed this whole area.
Yeah.
People would arrive. At one point, there was a railroad depot, a spur, that people could get off the train at the south end of Litchfield Road down by MC 85 and take a ride up Litchfield Road, which was lined with trees, to kind of guide the way to the resort, and would take you the 4 miles up to the wigwam. And then what people were going to experience was kind of the whole Western experience. They had horseback rides, they had cookouts, they had wagon rides, they had hay rides. They had at one point an arena, they would hold rodeos, they had singing cowboy entertainers. So people were coming out for the full Western experience. But also there was very luscious and well-planted grounds with lots of lawn space for archery, lawn bowling, and so forth. And yeah, so it was just really a place for people to be outside and enjoy the outdoors in the winter.
This part of the valley at that time, I would imagine, was maybe even a little more rural than places on the east side of town. Did that play into the ability of, you know, the wigwam to market itself as a true Western experience?
I think so. And also another thing that the wigwam liked to promote is its image as an oasis in the desert. And because it was separate from the metro area at the time, from Phoenix, that also made it more of a retreat. And actually, we know that a lot of celebrities would choose to stay here to kind of have a quiet getaway, and that the staff would kind of keep their stays here quiet so that they could have that privacy.
So moving forward now into like the 40s, 50s, 60s, mm-hmm. did the wigwam continue just to expand over the years?
It did. You have all these periods of expansion over the decades. So opening to the public in 1929 was kind of like the first major expansion. Somewhere along the 1940s, before the war, there might have been some improvement of the golf course. And then post-war is when it's really kind of the golden age, where they really invested in expanding the accommodations, and also really kind of turning the focus more and more towards the resort as being a golf destination and developing that side. But I think the Western experience, that piece was always part of the experience as well. And one of the things that you often hear is that when guests checked into the hotel, they were issued a horse and a towel.
Huh. Is the Western feel still a big part of this hotel? I mean, obviously, you know, looking around the decor, you can tell, but is it still part of the experience for people who stay here?
Yeah, you can definitely see it in the decor and in, you know, the whole aesthetic of the place. But, you know, there's no more cowboy singers, there's no stable, there's no arena, there's no horseback rides.
You don't get a horse when you check in
anymore. No horses when you check in anymore, yeah.
What does this resort mean for the community? I mean, how big of a driver is it? How big of a sort of source of pride is it for Litchfield Park and for this part of the valley?
It is a huge source of pride. You know, throughout the decades, proms were held here. Goodyear Farms, if they had employee events, they held them here at the Wigwam. It was just a part of everybody's life. Even the grounds were open, and there is kind of an open feel here. The community can come and have dinner and walk the grounds. And the swimming pools at one point were open to community members to come and swim in. So, yeah, I think for people who have lived here a long time, they have memories of bringing their kids over. And you know, it is a point of pride for sure.
When you think about the role that the Wigwam has played in sort of showing the valley and introducing people to Phoenix, where do you think, like, how do you think it played into that?
Oh, well, I think originally it really kind of tried to meet those expectations of interacting with the West and getting a sense of what the West of the past was like, and maybe forming a perception for visitors that way. And then I also think they were shaping the perception of this as a garden spot. You know, there is a lot of fertile farmland historically throughout Phoenix, and the way they landscaped around here with, you know, the money they would invest in the flowers and the lawns and so forth. So I think those are two perceptions that they would try to highlight, is that it was, you know, a place to escape and be outside and to escape the cold and to enjoy sort of like this oasis garden setting.
So you've been coming here for a long time and you come here a lot.
Yeah.
What goes through your mind when you walk through the halls here?
I look forward to any reason to being here just because I like the atmosphere. I like the feeling of the place. It feels homey, it feels comfortable, and it has that sense of history to it, and the, you know, that Southwest aesthetic. It seems genuine, you know. So it's just a lovely space, and it just, I don't know, it's a human scale, and it feels comfortable. Yeah.
All right. Well, Lisa, thank you so much for meeting me here, and thanks for sharing the stories. I appreciate it.
No, my pleasure.
Lisa Hegarty is executive director at the PW Litchfield Heritage Center. Next Tuesday, in the next installment of our series, Last Resorts, we'll look at how health and wellness helped shape the early tourism industry here in the Valley. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. For 126 years, black men in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints were barred from holding the priesthood. Both black women and men weren't allowed in the temple. It was a longstanding and controversial racially motivated ban that wasn't lifted until 1978, after the civil rights movement took hold in America. But as our next guest outlines in his new book, the lifting of the ban wasn't the end of the story. Matthew Harris is the author of Second Class Saints, Black Mormons and the Struggle for Racial Equality. I spoke with him more about it, beginning with how far back in LDS history the ban went.
Joseph Smith, the founding prophet of Mormonism, when he founded it in 1830, black men were allowed to hold the priesthood, but his successor, Brigham Young, implemented a policy or a ban in 1852. It began when a couple of black men had taken polygamous white wives, and Brigham Young didn't like that. Mormons were known to practice polygamy, or plural marriage, as they put it, in the early days of the church.
Right.
And when black men started taking white wives, that's when he started this priesthood and temple ban.
Hmm. So what did it mean for black people within the church? Like, did they participate in the church in other ways, or were there just not that many of them?
Well, in the 19th century, there were not a lot of black Latter-day Saints, and they did have some privileges in the church. They could enjoy limited temple privileges. The operative word is limited. They couldn't get married in the temple, which is one of the higher church ordinances, that you could be married as a man and a wife. But in the 20th century, their participation was up and down, depending on who the church president was and depending on where they worshiped. Some of the local lay leaders called bishops allowed them to speak in church. Others did not.
So I want to talk then about the bulk of the book here, which is about when this started to change, right? Like, talk about the sort of outside pressure, what was happening in the world around the LDS Church when the people in the hierarchy started to reconsider this kind of in the mid-20th century.
The church started to globalize in the mid-20th century after the Second World War, and globalization means just what it sounds like. They wanted to bring the gospel into every kindred, nation, tongue, and people, which is a biblical injunction. But they realized right away that that would be difficult to do if they couldn't go into sub-Saharan Africa because of the priesthood and temple ban. Mm. Also, the NAACP during the civil rights movement and other civil rights groups started to really, really pressure the church to lift its ban because they saw the theology underlying the ban as intrinsically connected with racial equality, that is, civil rights. And so they started to put pressure on the church to lift the ban so that they could support civil rights.
Interesting. So for this book, you went deep into the archives of the church, right, and found private papers from people who were in the hierarchy of the church at the time when this discussion started to happen. What did they show you about how this came about and the sort of motivation that the church leaders had at the time for changing this?
Well, I was fortunate that I got access to the private papers of several key people in this story, including the prophet or Mormon president who lifted the ban, a guy named Spencer W. Kimball. So I got access to his papers, his journals, his diaries, his correspondence, and also the meeting minutes of the first presidency and the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, the two highest governing bodies in the church. And I got access to private papers of other leaders as well. This story had never been told before because nobody ever had access to the papers that I had access to.
The church president at the time, right, began to, you wrote, kind of believe that this was morally wrong and started to think about it differently, it sounds like.
Yeah. So Spencer W. Kimball was the church president from 1973 to 1985. And before he was the church president, he saw how difficult it was on Black people, particularly in South America, where he had ecclesiastical responsibility as an apostle. And so a lot of Black people in South America would approach him and they would say, Elder Kimball, that's the title of a Mormon apostle. Mm. Elder Kimball, we want to hold the priesthood, but we can't. And he would go home that night and he would write in his diary how much experiences like that pained him because he wanted these faithful Latter-day Saints to enjoy the full privileges of the church, but they couldn't because of this ban.
Mm. Okay, so this finally changed in 1978 when Kimball made this official declaration, and it was that he would have had a revelation from God, right?
Yeah, so revelation in the Mormon parlance means something interesting. It means it's a process, not an event. And the process was, in Mormon scripture, there has to be a consensus of the two highest governing bodies of the church, the Quorum of the 12 Apostles and the First Presidency. So that's the revelation, is the consensus. And one of the fascinating chapters of the book is I talk about how President Kimball got that consensus. It took him 5 years to do it. He wanted to lift the ban the minute he became the church president in 1973, but he had to get buy-in from the Quorum of the 12 Apostles and his counselors in the First Presidency.
Talk about the back and forth there. Like, what was the conversation like?
Well, one of the selling points that he used was a temple that had been announced in Brazil. And what Kimball told his associates is that they were building this temple in this heavily biracial country. And none of these folks, these Brazilians, would be able to attend the temple because you had to hold a temple recommend, you had to have the priesthood. And of course, the ban precluded that. So they were donating their money and their time to build the temple. And it was a building that they wouldn't be able to enter despite sacrificing so much to make it happen.
So talk about what came next, right? Like the official revelation, this official change in church policy after, you know, so many years was a really big moment in the LDS church, I'm sure. But it sounds like that was not the end of the story here when it comes to how the church has kind of dealt with this legacy.
Not at all. In fact, when they announced the ban, it read more like a PR statement. It just simply said that Latter-day Saints of all races and ethnicities can now enjoy the privileges of the temple and hold the priesthood if they were worthy. But it didn't address the underlying rationales or doctrines that the church had used to sustain the ban for 126 years. And in Mormon discourse, Black people were denied the priesthood because of this so-called biblical curse that derived from the Old Testament, that Black people were cursed from God. And they didn't really address that. And they didn't say in 1978, this is no longer the teaching of the church. A lot of the Latter-day Saint leaders simply taught that the curse had been lifted in 1978. Huh. And for the next three decades, of course, Black Latter-day Saints were offended by that, and they pushed the church to repudiate that theology, which they did in 2013.
So they did, and relatively recently, yeah. Talk a little bit about what this legacy, what this kind of reckoning has done for the church and the Black community within it, and the wider Black community as well, its acceptance in America and in countries that are multiracial around the world.
Well, by lifting the ban, of course, that meant that the church could now globalize in sub-Saharan Africa and in other majority Black regions of the world. But the church hasn't done a very good job dealing with the residual fallout from the race, even though they repeated it in 2013, as I noted. The church sort of wants to move on and forget about the past teachings on race. And it's hard to move on unless you've fully owned it. And there are a lot of people in the Black community, for example, who are asking the church leaders to issue a formal apology for its past teachings, and that has yet to happen.
All right, we'll leave it there. Matthew Harris is author of Second Class Saints, Black Mormons, and the Struggle for Racial Equality. Matthew, thank you for coming on. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us about this. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was a pleasure, Lauren. Thank you for having me.
And that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening. Remember, you can always follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org, and you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.